In the opening of chapter 5, we saw a parable and song as Isaiah described a vineyard of his beloved. As we closed in the 7th verse, we discovered the application, in case we had missed it otherwise, that Israel was the vineyard and that the men of Judah were God's pleasant plant. We concluded that verse by saying that God wanted justice and righteousness, but He got wild grapes. He wound up getting from Israel bloodshed and a cry. God is now ready to pronounce judgment upon Israel. And beginning in verse 8 of chapter 5, we enter into 6 woes that God pronounces upon Israel. The first one is woe to the greedy land barons. Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field until there is no more room. And you are made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without habitation. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but 1 bath, and a homer of seed shall yield but 1 ephah. Here's the punishment for conduct that he's described before. God's people were characterized by avarice and greed, and the wealthy land barons would go out and they would buy plot after plot after plot and house after house after house until they owned them all and the poor folks had none. It was as if they just wanted to purchase them for the sake of ownership. It's sort of like America today. We are in a contest with those around us to see who can amass the most toys and the most gadgets. And we wind up spending money we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people we don't like. Well, the land barons were doing all of that. They were going out and buying all of these things. Micah described their conduct well when he said, "Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it." They're up all night thinking about what they can do to people. And then when they wake up, they practice it because it is in the power of their hand. They do it not because it's right. They do it because they can. And they covet fields and seize them and houses and take them away. And they oppress a man in his house, even a man and his heritage. Therefore, thus saith Jehovah, behold, against this family do I devise an evil from which ye shall not remove your necks, neither shall ye walk haughtily, for it is an evil time. Micah chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. God reveals the punishment. God speaks to Isaiah because Isaiah says, "In mine ears, the Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing," the English Standard says. And he says, here's what's going to happen. You've got all these fancy houses. You've got all these fancy homes. You've got your winter home. You've got your summer home. You've got your fall home. You've got your spring home. Let me tell you that all of those houses are going to be desolate and they're going to be uninhabited. There's going to be nobody who's going to live in those things because I'm going to see that they're taken away from you. And you're not going to enjoy what you have spent your lifetime amassing. And furthermore, all the land that you bought, it's not going to yield anything to you. You go out and you've got 10 acres of land in a vineyard, you're going to get about 1 bath of wine. And you've got, he says, you're going to plant a homer of seeds. That's, as I understand it, about 6 bushels. And you're going to get 1/10 of a homer of grain. Very small, very sparse. The truth of the matter is that what Isaiah is doing here is that he says, here's what you've got and here's what you get. What you get is about a tenth of what they had. Now, I don't know how many folks in here we've got who have been active in farming, but Clotus has. And I have an idea that if Clotus only got a harvest that amounted to 10% of the seed that he planted, he would not consider that to be a very successful year. And God is saying, this is what I'm going to do. Now, could it be that God is imposing upon them a reverse tithe? I've given you much, I've blessed you, and I've asked for a tenth. You want much now and you haven't lived right. You're going to take much and you're going to wind up with a tenth of what you started with. That's number one. Number 11 to 17, verses 11 to 17. I'm not going to read these verses. I hope you read them before you came to class. That would be a very good practice. I feel my harness slipping here. I wonder whatever happened to good old-fashioned microphones. But we just don't have time to read all these verses. We're going so slow that if we're going to have any hope of covering Isaiah, we've got to do something to speed it up. So let me just pass over reading this and let me encourage you to read it before you come to class. We've all heard the saying, early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. And maybe there's some truth to that, I don't know. But such is not the case when you're doing it like the men of Judah did. They went to bed late because they were having an evening of drinking. And they got up early so they could start the process all over again. For them, it wasn't a matter of once in a while. It was absolutely a daily habit. According to the Hebrew scholar Delitzsch, what they drank came not only from the grape, but from other sources, wines made from fruit, from honey, raisins, dates, etc., including barley wine or beer. Verse 12 reveals that they were not only drunkards, but they were revelers. They had their music, and that's what Isaiah is saying here. They were partiers. They did not attend to the things of God because they were too busy, Isaiah is telling us, having a good time. They didn't consider the things of God at all. They were too busy running to riot to attend to religion. They were fixing to learn the truth. And the truth is, look not thou upon the wine when it's red, when it sparkleth in the cup, when it goeth down smoothly, at the last it biteth like a serpent and it stingeth like an adder. They ignored the God of glory, and he was fixing to teach them a lesson. They gave the judgment of God no thought. Or if they did give it any thought, they did so by saying, well, you know, we're the people of God. And because we're the people of God, God can't punish us. God won't punish us. God won't lift a hand against us. After all, we are the chosen people. Edward Young, in his commentary, suggests that what they were really ignoring was the eternal purpose of God to bring salvation to the world through Jesus Christ. And that they were too busy being occupied by the very sins that were leading them to destruction. And they paid no attention at all to the consequences of those sins. Verses 13 and 14, God again speaks of judgment. The people will go into captivity. Now notice that Isaiah puts it sort of in the present tense. My people go into exile like it was happening then. But the truth of the matter is, it didn't happen until many years later. So why is Isaiah describing it as something that was then going on? What we have here is one of the first occurrences, and we'll see many of them through the book of Isaiah, of what is called in Scripture the prophetic perfect. God has spoken. God has said, this will happen. And the prophets of God are so absolutely certain that what God said would happen, would in fact happen, that they put it in the present tense as if it had already happened. Because when God says something about the future, it is just as certain to happen as the certainty of the things that are past, that they happen. It's just as sure that the future will happen when God says it's going to happen. So that's what Isaiah is doing here. It's called the prophetic perfect. And we'll see it over and over again in the book of Isaiah. God's children in this context did not know how to read the signs of the time. Hosea 4:6 says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. These people didn't have knowledge of God. They knew only one thing, and that was how to have a good time. Those who drank long of the wine and parted into the night will now be famished and thirsty, God says. There's a second therefore here in verse 14 which indicates that the judgment is not yet finished, and it's going to be finished with Sheol. Sheol here probably refers to the grave or the tomb, which is the end result for all of us unless we're living when the Lord comes again. And Sheol here is pictured as being famished and hungry, and it's opening its mouth wide to receive these partying, sinful people of God with all of their pomp and all of their circumstance. It will be destroyed. Verses 15 and 16 recall the language of chapter 2, verses 9, 11, and 17. Both men great and small, humble and great, are brought low. On the other hand, there will be one thing that will come out of it with glory, and that is the God of glory, above whom there is no one else. And he will be exalted in his justice, and the God who is holy will be sanctified in his righteousness. The end result is that wild animals will roam the land. It'll be grown up with thorns and thistles. If you look at your handout, you see a picture of an artist's conception of the vineyard of desolation. And I will tell you that I pulled that just to show you how one man envisioned it. But I will also tell you that with my imagination, I can see something far worse than this artist depicted here. When you read what God says is going to happen. Woe 3. Woe to them who are enslaved to sin. Verses 18 and 19. This woe is pronounced upon those who are so enslaved to sin that they are pictured as pulling the weight of their iniquity like a dumb animal, harnessed up to the wagon to pull it and to carry it. That's how God is depicting his people, just like they were beasts of burden. The cords with which they draw their iniquities are their falsehoods, their lies, and they draw their sins with a cart rope. They are slaves to their sin-ridden life. Do you believe Proverbs 13:15, the way of the transgressor is hard? Here is surely an example of the truthfulness of that statement. There is no more severe taskmaster in this world than sin. Egypt never treated the people of God as badly as they were treating themselves. They were harming themselves far more than the cruelest of the Egyptian taskmasters. Worse yet is the attitude that they displayed before their God. Read these verses carefully. Oh, Isaiah. Paraphrasing. Tell your God to bring it on. You say He's going to do these things to us, Isaiah. Bring it on. Let's see what He can do. Let's see what He will do. And they even mocked His name. The Holy One of Israel, the name by which Isaiah often calls his God. Surely the people of God had become atheists, at least of the practical sort of like the rich fool. They would not believe unless they saw God in action. Do you realize how easy it is to be flippant about things when the sky is clear? Oh, we're not going to have any trouble. God's not going to do anything to us. Look at the sky. Look at what we've got. God has blessed. We are His people. But when we take that attitude, folks, one of these days the sky is going to be darkened. And that's when we're going to head to the hills and the mountains and cry for them to fall on us and cover us up. The lightning flashes and the thunder rolls, and we have nowhere to go and no protection. And when that happens, it's far too late to sing, Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in Thee. Well, those who are irreverent, and God's people certainly were, are also people, having disregarded God, also disregard His law. Verse 20, next woe. Woe to those who confuse moral distinctions. We will read this one. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who give out darkness for light and light for darkness, who give out bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. They had made the God of Israel and the law of the God of Israel a subject of ridicule. And it sort of had become the butt of their jokes. And this fourth woe relates to those who adopted a code of morals that completely overturned the ethical principles of the law of God. Irreverence and deep depravity are brothers. And they always go hand in hand. Those who reject God and who challenge Him with irreverence are also those who break down all moral distinctions and redefine all ethical obligations. And I can't leave this section, which I'm about to do, without one final question. Does this remind you of the United States of America? It does not bode well for us, good people. Verse 21, woe to the self-deceived. The woes keep coming, and the conduct of God's people continues to degenerate. This woe is pronounced upon people who believe that they are smarter than God. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. You want a terrible thought? If there is no God, or if we reject God, there is nothing left upon which we can depend other than ourselves and other men. In many ways in my life, I've depended on many men. But never, ever have I depended upon anything from any man when it comes to those things that are eternal and of value. Smarter than God? Heavens above the earth. That's how it's described in Scripture, the distance between our thoughts and God's thoughts and His ways and our ways. But folks, that's hyperbole, and hyperbole, though it serves the purpose, can never equal the reality. So it really doesn't even reach the difference between God's wisdom and our wisdom. Can I get along without God? The people of Israel thought they could, and God is now telling us what's going to happen to people who think they can get by without God. Woe to the perverters of justice, verses 22 and 23. You know, it is a wonderful thing for us to have men of integrity and leadership who, before all of us, can become our mighty men and heroes. Every little boy growing up needs a hero. I had mine, and on Saturday when I had a nickel, I could go down to the movie and see them, Gene Autry and Roy Rogers. Well, maybe that's not the kind of hero I'm really talking about, but to little boys it may be. To whom can we look today as our heroes? Where are they? Professional athletes? Some say there's a football team that can't even huddle because it violates their parole. They cannot associate with other convicted criminals. Basketball players? See what they do. Steroids forbidden. But I can hit another home run if I just take these pills. Whatever happened to goodness? Whatever happened to honesty? Whatever happened to doing things the right way? That which is good and that which is right. Well, Israel was in the same condition we are. Because these fellows, their heroes, as it were, lent their might and strength to win drinking and drink-mixing contests. And worst of all, verse 23 indicates that these men were the judges and the rulers who, when they were not busy with drinking bouts, spent their time taking bribes and depriving the righteous righteousness and justice. Their greedy hearts were interested in only one thing, and that was profit. And so justice was for sale to the highest bidder. The poor didn't have a chance. Well, what does this tell us? What God is telling us with these woes is that the folks of Israel did not escape the consequences of their evil deeds. Isaiah uses two illustrations to demonstrate that. There, the fire, verse 24, and the earthquake, verse 25, resulting in loss of life so severe that they lay as refuse in the street. And all of this disaster is traced to one primary cause. They have rejected the law of Jehovah of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. And that gets to the bottom of all of the conduct that is described in these six woes. The psalmist said, Psalm 119 and verse 11, "Thy word have I laid up or hidden in my heart, that I might not sin against thee." And when the law of God and the will of God is rejected and His word is despised, there is no hope for the person or the nation engaged in that conduct. But notice that it says, "Yet for all of this, His anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised." And that statement occurs again in chapter 9 and verse 12, verse 17, verse 21, chapter 10 and verse 4. And it's written to denote the continuing anger of God over the sins of His people. And if we don't learn anything else in all of our study of Isaiah, we do need to learn, absolutely need to learn, and never forget the seriousness with which God takes sin, whether it be the sin of others or the sins of His people. But a more terrible judgment's on the way. Look at verses 26 to 30. God is raising a flag, an ensign. He's calling nations from afar. And they're going to come from the far end of the earth, and they shall respond, and they will come quickly. They're not going to tire. They're not going to slumber or sleep. They will not loosen their war dress or take off their shoes. Their arrows are sharp, and their bows are ready. Their horses will not become lame, or their chariots get flats. They'll roar like a lion as they lay hold on their prey and carry it away, and none can deliver them. Hurricane Ike has hit the land. Isaiah does not here identify who this marauder is that God is calling, but he will later identify it as Assyria. Well, Brother Hall, this is ancient history. What in the world do we need to worry about? Do we need to worry? My answer is absolutely. Because too much of the conduct that Isaiah describes here is characteristic of our nation. And I will add, characteristic of too much of the church. And now as then, the result comes from an erroneous world view. Our modern world has become egocentric. It's governed by us. There is no meaning to life except the meaning I give it. There is no absolute truth for everybody. There is my truth, and there is your truth, and never the twain shall meet. Which means if there are 6 billion or how many ever billion people there are upon this earth, there can be 6 billion or plus different truths. Do you believe that? Nobody with any common sense believes it in life. They just believe it as a philosophy of life and guide themselves by it. The consequences of this no meaning, no truth philosophy are staggering in our society. We live in a society that has laws. For instance, we live in a society that does not permit lying and stealing. Why? Because we know that a society that permits lying and stealing is a society that cannot exist. But when it comes to ourselves, when it comes to the meaning of my life, when it comes to my truth, then I cut myself some slack. A little lie here. A little theft there. A little murder of somebody's reputation. Now, that's not so bad. After all, we live in a dog-eat-dog world, and we just can't exist in it without that kind of conduct. What a change has occurred in our country. There was a time in our country when a handshake was all you needed. There was a time in our country when truth reigned. There was a time in our country when we had a biblical, ethical, and moral stance. But our present generations, notice the S, are doing our best to kill that ethic. What little of it that is left is there because people who went before us built up that ethic. Instead of following it, a nation of laws respected around the world because we could live that way, now has no respect at all because we have no laws to govern our conduct and we ignore them and live as we want to live. Somehow we believe that we can obtain all of the benefits of life by living only for ourselves and our own pleasure. Oh, well, you're talking about all those folks out there. You're not talking about the church, Brother Hall. Well, let me talk for a minute about Christendom in the broadest sense with quotation marks around it. Studies show that Christian teenagers are as apt to cheat in school as any other teenagers. It demonstrates that among Christian young people, more than half think there are no absolute moral standards. Well, Brother Hall, those are the kids, and we're still training them. Among those who in the religious world call themselves evangelicals, the divorce rate is higher than it is for the rest of the nation. Does that sound like we can even begin to commence to start to suggest that we are following the one who created the world and created us in His image? Well, how in the world did we get here? Verse 24, repeat it, learn it, memorize it. We have rejected the law of Jehovah of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. There is a right and a wrong, and they exist because the God of glory, the Creator God who created the universe, said they're right and wrong. I know the psychologists tell us as parents we should never say, because I said so. I don't fall for that garbage either. I think my kids will tell you that. Because God said so is absolute reason enough. The nice thing about God is that when He says so, He always has our best interest at heart. He is holy, and He commands us to be holy. He expects us to be holy because we're made in His image. There's nothing else that I can think of that can explain what has gone wrong in this country. Oh, well, Brother Hall, it's those commercials. You know how they are. We all remember the one that said, go for the gusto, you only go around once. Well, you only go around once is true. Hebrews 9:27 is pointed unto man once to die, and after this, the judgment. What they're ignoring is the judgment. But the truth of the matter is, if we had not forgotten the law of Jehovah, and if we had not failed to respect the word of the Holy One of Israel, commercials like that would have absolutely no impact on us at all. Unless there is a God in heaven whose word and authority determines that which is right and that which is wrong, there is absolutely nothing in this world to keep right from becoming wrong, and light from becoming darkness, and falsehood from becoming truth. And as an individual, as a church, and as a congregation of the Lord's people, we must be absolutely certain that we always bow before the word of our eternal God. If we don't, the salt will have lost its savor, and it will be good for nothing except to be cast out and trodden under the foot of men. Good people, behavior has consequences. In the natural world, it may cost us our life. In the spiritual world, it will cost us our soul. Chapter 6. I don't know what we're going to do, folks. We are never going to finish Isaiah in the time allotted. I cannot do it. And I'm beginning to realize that. I cannot do it and do Isaiah justice. I cannot do it and not comment on things like I did this morning, because that's what Isaiah is trying to tell us. And if we ignore that, I'll just stop right there. Let me just set the stage for next week. First bell has rung. In your handout, you have, again, an artist's conception of the vision of Isaiah. Chapter 6 is a very short chapter, but that doesn't mean we'll get it all covered. Because one commentator has described chapter 6 as being the majestic peak in the terrain of Isaiah's prophecy. And it truly is. Woe is me. I am undone. For I have unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of the people with unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the Lord. Now, that seems rather simple. But who was it that Isaiah saw? Ever thought about that? And why was Isaiah given a negative message to preach? You read those opening verses, and verses 6 and 7, I think is where his commission comes in. And it doesn't sound like the Great Commission. You go and save people. It sounds like Isaiah, you go and push them farther into the pit. Why would God do that? Those are some of the questions we're going to have to deal with in Isaiah chapter 6. And they're important questions if we're going to understand Isaiah. I apologize for the slowness. Maybe we can speed up a bit when we get to over around 13 and 14, because there Isaiah reaches the burden of the nations, the oracles of God against the nations. And there's a great deal of similarity through that, and it goes from chapter 13 through, I forget what it is, 20 or so. And we may be able to cover those fast. One of the problems I have in covering them rapidly is that I'm also preparing notes for the website, thywordistruth.com. And I'm leaving out a lot that is in my notes. I simply cannot present it all. Even if we had more time, I couldn't do that and wouldn't. But if you want to know some things more about it, you can find them at thywordistruth.com. And you can see the videos of the lesson as well as hear it in audio. So it's all there if you want to go into it a little bit more in the notes that have been prepared. And frankly, it's taken a lot of time. Millie's beginning to call me old what's-his-name, because I spend my time in the study. And to get these notes done from all the sources I'm using, it takes a good 30-plus hours a week. And I'm just glad I'm retired, because I couldn't do it otherwise. But I hope that it's valuable to you. I hope it is close to being as valuable as it has been for me. I know the teacher always gains most from a class. And I will tell you that what I have gained has been a blessing, and I hope it has for you. Next week, chapter 6.